This is Law and Disorder.
Today on Law and Disorder, we talk to the two editors of the new book, In Defense of Julian Assange.
It's no exaggeration to say that if the United States government under Trump drags him out of his prison cell in London and tries and convicts him of conspiracy in a Virginia court and gets him convicted as being a spy, it's a threat to world investigative journalism.
We're joined by Brad Schreiber, author of the book, Music is Power, Popular Songs, Social Justice, and the Will to Change.
This is a wonderful book. I just thought of all these songs when I was reading it. Brad fleshes it out when we speak to him. Good interview.
Stay with us.
I'm New York City attorney and author Michael Stephen Smith.
And I'm New York City attorney and activist Heidi Boghossian.
Whistleblowing, truth-telling journalist and WikiLeaks founder Julian Assange now sits in solitary confinement in London's infamous Belmarsh prison. The Trump administration has asked that he be extradited to Virginia for trial as a spy. Today we interview Margaret Kunstler and Tariq Ali, who edited and introduced the just-published book In Defense of Julian Assange. The book demonstrates convincingly that what is at stake in his upcoming trial is the future of free journalism here and abroad. Julian faces a 175-year sentence under the century-old Espionage Act, passed during World War I to be used against spies. He is charged with conspiring with Chelsea Manning to publish the Iraq war logs, the Afghanistan war logs, and State Department cables. Former CIA director and current Secretary of State Mike Pompeo has called WikiLeaks a, quote, non-state intelligence service, close quote. Hillary Clinton wanted him assassinated by drone. The United Nations Special Rapporteur on Torture, Nils Melzer, recently visited him in prison and concluded that indeed he was being tortured. When he last appeared in court, he was incoherent and couldn't remember his name or date of birth. WikiLeaks was launched by Julian Assange in 2006, 3 years after Bush and Cheney commenced the illegal, catastrophic war against Iraq in 2003. Julian is a computer genius. He invented a way for publishers like WikiLeaks to receive truth-telling information anonymously. The first bombshell he published in 2006 was the Iraq War Logs. He got them from whistleblower Chelsea Manning, who was then in the military. They showed a video of American soldiers in a helicopter committing a war crime by gunning down and executing a number of Iraqi civilians, two Reuters journalists, and several children. Then they chuckled about it. The photo of the murders is shown on the book's cover. This leak, furnished by Chelsea Manning, was devastating to the United States. Other whistleblower leaks followed. The government became relentless in trying to close down WikiLeaks. Margaret Kunstler is a longtime civil rights attorney in New York City. Tariq Ali is a British socialist scholar and author. We are speaking to him in London. Margaret is in our New York City studio. Tariq and Margaret, welcome back to Law and Disorder.
Thank you.
Very good to be with you again.
Julian Assange is in prison in London waiting to be extradited to East Virginia for trial. Margaret, we want to talk about what the U.S. government is alleging he did. You chose to print the indictment in your book, and you've done criminal defense work your whole life. Talk about the indictment, and then, if you will, please explain the Espionage Act.
Well, the indictment is a 17-count indictment with charges under the Espionage Act, and one charge that's based on the Computer Fraud Act. Indictment itself is a violation of the First Amendment. The First Amendment, you know, it allows free speech, and the only limits on that is a clear and present danger. And what we have here is an alternative universe, which suddenly says that this is not free speech, this is espionage. Now, you can't have an espionage charge against a journalist or a publisher, because that is limiting free speech. So the entire indictment is illegal and a violation of the First Amendment. So that's the first step. The second step is, even under the Espionage Act, the charge of conspiracy fails because Julian was not conspiring with Chelsea Manning. He was receiving information from Chelsea Manning, and therefore it was not a conspiracy. If you look at the indictment itself and read, forgetting about the charges themselves, and read the fact pattern, it comes from an alternative universe. Every fact pattern is a First Amendment protected activity. Julian, for example, speaks at an open forum and says, send me whatever you want to send me. Now that's totally a protected activity. Or Julian publishes a list that is called the Most Wanted List. That list is not authored by Julian, but by human rights attorneys all over the world who get together and sit in a room and say, what do we want? And so they're accusing Julian of putting that list up, and they're saying, oh, so he's asking for it. And asking for it makes it outside of the normal First Amendment protections. So the entire indictment is outrageous. It's a political charge. It violates the First Amendment, and it has really nothing to do with the laws of the United States, which have developed freely around the First Amendment and clearly have said that the only exception to the First Amendment is a clear and present danger.
Now, Margaret, what is his current legal situation?
He is currently denied bail on the espionage charge, and that is the only thing that is holding him in a maximum security prison under terrible circumstances.
Tariq, Mike Pompeo, the former director of the Central Intelligence Agency and Trump's current Secretary of State, stated that Julian was not a journalist, but rather he was running a, quote, foreign intelligence service. Your thoughts on this, please.
Well, my thoughts on this are that Pompeo uttering remarks like this is so absurd and borders on the edge of sanity. I mean, I honestly believe that he knows it's a lie, but he's saying it. But if he actually believes the stuff, he needs urgent medical attention because it's obvious to everyone what Julian is, what he did, and why he's being punished. I mean, you know, when a U.S. Army private, Chelsea then Bradley Manning, leaked hundreds of thousands of secret government documents relating to the wars in Iraq and Afghanistan in 2010 and exposing war crimes committed by the United States, they were immediately counterattacked by the right and by supporters of the wars, to whom Manning became enemy number one. She had to be punished, and the demands arose even then, very soon after the WikiLeaks published these documents, that Julian should be extradited and dealt with in the United States. That's all he did. He published the documents, and then WikiLeaks' exposures, many of them, were published simultaneously by The Guardian in London, The New York Times in New York, El País in Madrid, and La Repubblica in Italy. Four liberal newspapers published this. So are they going to be charged as well? If not, why not? Why target Julian? He just made them available. So if the crime is publishing these things, he shouldn't be the only one in prison. In fact, no one should be in prison. But there's an inconsistency. To say that he's running an intelligence service, I mean, it honestly is crazy. And even the most craven judge in the United States will find it difficult to see what the evidence is, if in fact they've got any evidence at all. They'll have to fake some evidence. God knows what's that going to be. It's absurd.
We're speaking with Margaret Kunstler here in New York and with Tariq Ali in London. They've edited the just-published book, In Defense of Julian Assange, which you can get at orbooks.com. Tariq, the United States launched Operation Iraqi Liberation in 2003. And in 2010, WikiLeaks released the Iraq war logs and the Afghanistan war logs. What was the historical significance of that?
Well, what the war logs revealed was the truth. You know, what was going on in Iraq, why it had been invaded, including some archive material which shocked the world, which was the killing of Iraqi civilians in a random fashion. We saw helicopter attacks knocking out civilians. We saw the destruction of an Iraqi family simply because it was Iraqi on the road for a bit of fun. And it brought home the realities and truths of the war, which had not been revealed at that time by the mainstream media. So it did create a sensation and a great deal of anger, because lots of people, unfortunately, at that time, tend to believe Western propaganda as to why the war was being fought. And the revelation of why the war was really being fought to defend and protect U.S. hegemony in the region, to recolonize Iraq, and the behavior and the tortures being inflicted on the Iraqi people did create a storm. And that is what projected WikiLeaks and Julian to where they remain now, you know, as truth tellers. And as people prepared to defy the world's mightiest army and armed forces and propaganda networks in order to bring the truth home, that's what they did. And that's why he's not been forgiven.
Margaret, can you talk about how Julian invented a way for whistleblowers to release information anonymously?
Yes, Julian developed this program where people who had information that they wanted to get to him could send him the information and remain totally anonymous. And there would be no way for Julian to know or anybody else to know who sent that information. And that was critically important because it protected the whistleblower. And this was the first program of this sort that totally protected the whistleblower. Subsequent to that, there were some other programs added, but they haven't worked as well.
And I'm sure for that invention, Julian didn't enamor himself to the government.
No, I'm sure he didn't.
What did WikiLeaks do to expose the Democratic National Committee's bias and machinations against Bernie Sanders in favor of Hillary Clinton?
I think WikiLeaks' exposure of the Clinton emails played a big part in liberal hatred for Julian Assange, and a total refusal by most liberals, mainstream liberals, to defend him. And I think there's very little doubt that it was the WikiLeaks exposure that inspired Edward Snowden, a private analyst then at the NSA, to expose the staggering extent of its illegal surveillance of U.S. citizens and foreigners, including staunch U.S. allies like the German Chancellor Angela Merkel. So the extent of what the NSA was up to, which was not revealed by WikiLeaks, but actually probably inspired Edward Snowden to do what was required. I mean, Edward had no radical background whatsoever, but was just angered by what he found out when he heard the NSA bosses testifying before the Senate and saying that they did not conduct illegal surveillance of U.S. citizens, which was a total lie, and Snowden knew it. So both Snowden and other whistleblowers in different parts of the world, and more whistleblowers to come, will without any doubt be inspired by that. And I think our defense of Julian has to be a broad one. Obviously, in the American court, if he gets there, he'll be faced with specific charges. But the real reason for the extradition is that he's a bad example. And they want to nip these things in the bud to frighten people, saying, don't do it. If you do it, remember what we did to Assange. To come to your question, I haven't been inside the prison. No, I last met Julian just before he went to prison. And I asked him the following. I said, is there anything you think that could stop the extradition? I mean, we'll do whatever we can. And he said the only thing that would stop it is a Labour government led by Jeremy Corbyn. This will, might or might not happen, but the election is on the 12th of December. And many members of Jeremy Corbyn's team have said, have defended Julian, and have said that they will look at this issue fresh if they come to power December the 12th. So I think Julian is right. That is the only hope. Interestingly enough, the judge appointed to try Julian for the extradition, Justice Arbuthnot, is herself a well-known security judge, i.e. judges approved by the security services for trying difficult cases. Her husband is well-known in the arms trade. They're totally linked up to various and nefarious enterprises like arms dealing. So they've got a safe judge, the British judicial establishment. So we shouldn't be too surprised by that verdict. The only question is whether we can stop it. If he's tried, that court will come out for extradition.
Proof of Arbuthnot's prejudice is very interesting. Just the other day, she released on bail two people who were accused of murder. There was an extradition aspect to India, and Arbuthnot gave these people bail and freed them, even though they were charged with murder, while on the other hand, Julian, who is not charged with anything violent and only providing information, is held without bail. So that's kind of, you know, really significant in terms of her bias.
Margaret, why did the Obama administration not indict Julian? After all, his administration indicted 8 whistleblowers, and that was more than all prior presidents combined, and now Trump has indicted 8, including Julian.
Julian's situation is different. He is not a hacker. He is not a whistleblower. He is a publisher and a journalist. And this is the first time that a publisher has been charged under the Espionage Act. And I think the Obama administration saw that that wasn't a wise thing to do because that was violative of the First Amendment.
I'd like to ask both of you, what's at stake here? Is it an exaggeration to claim that what's at stake is the future of investigative journalism?
There's no question that the future of investigative journalism is at stake. If a journalist cannot seek out information, the journalist cannot function. A journalist is an investigator. And what this accusation is that you can't be an investigator. You can't even receive this information without doing anything. Just the mere publishing of it and the mere conversation about it with the whistleblower is sufficient to charge you with espionage violations, which is outrageous. And if you're a journalist and this is what your future is about, then you're really in trouble. And also the future of the liberty of this country is at stake, because if we can't reveal what the powerful people in this country are carrying on, then we have no control, and there's no way of stopping this, and we just head on to fascism.
I think that controlling investigative journalism has been a central project of governments for the last 20 years, and they've more or less been successful. I mean, The Guardian and The New York Times and others publishing WikiLeaks and then publishing Edward Snowden's revelations is not work that they had done themselves, because in most cases, including to a certain extent in the liberal press, there is no department for special investigations anymore. Occasionally they do it, but rarely. So they themselves have been very dependent on what WikiLeaks and Snowden have done and claimed the credit. I'd be a bit more impressed, in fact, if they were defending Assange with some vigor. In fact, they're not defending him at all. And the news today that the Swedish government has now stopped investigating those charges, which many of us thought at the time were not credible, linked to rape, if the Swedes have now dropped these, it's a sign that what we thought at the time was correct, that he was being set up. And our book in defense of Julian Assange, which is a collection of writings, a number of authors take you through what has been done to Julian systematically. The slander campaigns, the assaults, the legal case, etc., etc. It's a deconstruction job that Margaret and I and others contributing to it have done, and we hope it has some impact, to be honest.
Margaret, can you put Julian's case in the perspective of the historic, recently accelerated decline of the rule of law and democracy back during the Vietnam War? As listeners know, the Supreme Court allowed publication of the Pentagon Papers. Could courts overthrow that precedent?
Well, we would think not, except that the judges in this country have been so changed by this administration that we don't know what to expect. There was a big effort to prevent the Pentagon Papers from coming out. Well, that was no easy task. There was an injunction against the production of those papers. And clearly, those papers, just like the papers that Julian has put out, were protected by the First Amendment. And clearly, I just want to add that the effort to get the Pentagon Papers took the reporters a tremendous amount of effort. It was no easy task. They were involved in getting that material before it was published, much more so than Julian today was involved.
The attorney for the Pentagon Papers, for the New York Times, at the time of the Pentagon Papers, was James Goodale. And he has commented on the book in defense of Julian Assange. The charge against Assange for conspiring with a source is the most dangerous I can think of with respect to the First Amendment in all my years representing media organizations. That's some heavy stuff. Tariq, let me ask you this. And Margaret, I'd like you to comment on this as well. Would you say that ultimately, considering how this case arose, that imperialism is incompatible with the rule of law and democracy?
Well, imperialism has been like that. But what we're witnessing now is capitalism in its homelands, in the United States in particular, but also increasingly mimicked by Western Europe, is creating a situation where the mainstream media is largely monolithic. There is very little diversity in what it writes or covers, apart from exceptional things like Donald Trump or Brexit, where there are divisions. By and large, on most affairs, they're in unison and harmony with the government of the day, and this has been getting worse and worse over the last 20 years. So I think that is a huge problem, which we've only managed to sort of fight back because of the internet. But there's now a lot of talk about censoring the internet, which some countries already do, like Iran and China, for instance. Then why shouldn't the Western governments do the same thing? So there's a permanent attempt now taking place to institutionalize censorship and to not just monopolize information, but release it only when it's safe.
Margaret, did you want to add to that?
Yes, you know, I would like to read just a paragraph from the book. It's a paragraph by Margaret Kimberly, and I think that some of these essays are fantastic, and I'm so pleased with them. Margaret Kimberly's is a beautiful essay, and I just want to read one paragraph from it. What little is left of American democracy depends upon the existence of a free and independent press. Julian Assange must be defended for that reason. He must be defended precisely because the ruling elites want to lock him up. His willingness to show us what war looks like or how trade agreements deprive millions of people of their rights make him an ally, not just as a person, but as an ally of the principles of Americans' claim to what they care about.
What kind of support is Julian getting in Great Britain and in the USA? Tariq, could you first talk about Britain?
Well, it's a campaign largely led by activists. You know, we are doing things, but it doesn't have any support within the media at all. It is not covered by any television network. the liberal press ignore us, the right-wing press want Assange to be extradited and threatened, including the top end of the right-wing media like The Economist. So it is really very much a minority campaign, but, you know, led by and participated in by good people, John Pilcher, Jeffrey Robertson, many people who contribute to our book. We've had a number of demonstrations in favor of Assange, one outside the prison, one outside the British Home Office, and the one outside the Home Office was larger, Roger Waters, Fang, and that was very popular. Julian's father came and spoke, but we operate in a very difficult environment as far as Julian is concerned, because the rape allegations alienated lots of young people from him. Completely, you know, I mean, it was very carefully and deliberately organized and orchestrated. So this book is part of building up some support for him again, and hopefully people who read it will realize what's at stake. But we do what can be done within the limits.
And Margaret, on the United States?
Well, I think it's quite similar to Britain, but I think that we're beginning to have a slight change in terms of journalists in this country beginning to understand the threat that this poses to them. And just, I think that where we are going to be first successful and will perhaps lead to a greater movement in this country will be the national security journalists who will reach out and talk about this in the public, in the media, in the mass media, because right now Julian does not reach the mass media. He's on Twitter, but he doesn't get beyond that. So I think once this information can get out, and probably and hopefully through these journalists, then we'll have a basis of support that we can build on.
We're speaking with attorney Margaret Kunstler here in New York and Tariq Ali, the historian, socialist activist in London. We're coming down to the end of our allotted time, unfortunately, but I just wanted to repeat that we're talking about the book In Defense of Julian Assange, just came out, Or Books, O-R Books, orbooks.com is how you can get it. Julian wrote a letter to Gordon Dimmack from his prison cell in London on May 13th of this year. Julian wrote, "I'm unbroken, albeit literally surrounded by murderers. But the days when I could read and speak and organize to defend myself, my ideas and my people are over until I am free. Everyone else must take my place. I am defenseless, and I am counting on you and others of good character to save my life. Truth ultimately is all we have." Margaret, Tariq, what can we do to help Julian?
Well, I think beginning to get support for him is going to be very helpful. And beginning to explain to people and let them understand that the character assassination that has gone on against him really was to distract from what the government was doing. It was not, it really, the way it proceeded and the way it blew up and the way it happened was not a normal hatred that developed. People just don't hate on that level simply because someone does something that they don't like. So it was definitely government orchestrated. And I think that this book will help explain to people that it was more of a distraction to take away from the reality of what the situation is and how important Julian's work is.
I agree strongly with that. No point in repeating it.
With that, I want to urge people, go to orbooks.com and get In Defense of Julian Assange. It's a marvelous book. The two of you are to be thanked profoundly for your good work in putting it together and for the brilliant introduction that you wrote. Tariq Ali, Margaret Kunstler, thank you so much for being on Law and Disorder.
Thank you very much.
Bye.
Visit us online at lawanddisorder.org for archived programs and links to many of the issues we discuss.
Throughout U.S. history, social justice music has played many roles, including inspiring activists fighting police repression during the civil rights movements. In his new book, Music is Power, author Brad Schreiber chronicles a century of politically conscious music. From Joe Hill, Woody Guthrie, Joan Baez, Bob Marley, even the Sex Pistols. Perhaps associated largely with folk music, social justice music indeed spans a range of genres, from rap, heavy metal, reggae, and psychedelia. Schreiber not only shines a spotlight on musicians' different approaches, from soulful ballads to expressions of anger, but he also tells engaging stories behind the public figures who have brought this music into our lives. There are many surprises in his animation of longtime favorites, many of whom overcame obstacles in bringing their messages of social justice to the recording industry and to the airwaves. Joining us today is award-winning author, journalist, and screenwriter Brad Schreiber. His previous books include Death in Paradise, Becoming Jimi Hendrix, and Revolution's End. He's received fellowships and awards from the National Press Foundation, the Edward Albee Foundation, the International Book Awards, Independent Publisher Book Awards, and the Los Angeles Press Club. Brad, welcome to Law and Disorder.
Thank you very much. It's a great pleasure to talk with both of you.
Brad, before we get into the book, which is wonderful, tell us, are you a musician, and how did you become interested in the topic of music and social justice?
Well, I think it's reflected, Heidi, in my last two books. Becoming Jimi Hendrix, which I wrote from the research of Hendrix historian Steve Roby in 2010, was the first book to look at his early life and talk about poverty, growing up in Seattle, being in the military, learning rhythm and blues in Nashville, and a lot of other aspects that shaped who Jimmy became. So I really got to feel like I knew who he was at the core. And then 3 years ago, I wrote Revolution's End, which is the first book to explain how under Governor Ronald Reagan, the Symbionese Liberation Army, which kidnapped Patty Hearst, was actually a construct that was using a black prisoner as a leader of a faux left-wing group in order to undercut the Black Panthers and the New Left in California, and it was devastatingly effective. So there you have it, music and politics in the last two books. And now we're dealing with a blend of the two in Music is Power.
Tell us about the early roots of political music in the United States.
Well, I felt that you had to start with Joe Hill and then move on to Woody Guthrie. And, of course, Woody Guthrie connects directly to Pete Seeger. So I said these three guys have to sort of be the beginning when unionizing and looking for more respect for American laborers was the guiding topic. And of course from there then you almost naturally move into, you know, Bob Dylan and Joan Baez. But even though the cover of Music is Power is an old Haight-Ashbury kind of design, this book really covers every genre of music, including comedy and metal and hip-hop, and pinpoints the songs that really did further the discussion about social justice in almost every genre of music you can think of.
Brad, let me ask you about Phil Oakes. He traveled down to Mississippi to listen to black civil rights activists, and he also visited poor white coal miners on strike in Kentucky. Talk about Oakes and his performing at the 1968 Democratic National Convention in Chicago.
Well, Michael, I was very fortunate at some point in this book because I got to know people who were either the subjects or who knew the subjects. So Phil Oakes is one of those people. I worked at KCRW, the NPR station in Santa Monica, when Michael Oakes had his archive show, and I talked quite a bit with him about Phil. And then this book is dedicated to Paul Krassner, who passed away, unfortunately, recently. He also gave me a lot of insight into Phil, who, you know, sang with, you know, all the theatrics of Abbie Hoffman and Jerry Rubin, you know, in Chicago during the convention. And it's understandable that Phil's next album had his own gravestone and his birth year, and he said that his death year was 1968 in Chicago. Many people often talk about, when did the 60s officially end? Oh, it was when Charles Manson and his followers killed people. No, I agree with Phil Oakes. The death of the 60s is the assassinations of Robert F. Kennedy, Martin Luther King, and the failure of the Democratic Party in 1968 to nominate an anti-war, a strong anti-war candidate, and instead came up with Hubert Humphrey, who, of course, lost to Richard Nixon. So, you know, Oakes is one of those people whose body of work was phenomenal and dealt with every socio-political topic you could think of.
Brad, you quote civil rights activist Julian Bond on the influence of black church songs, which often use the words, "I'll overcome." He said the first time he heard "We Shall Overcome" at the SNCC Organizing Committee was at the SNCC Organizing Committee. Mm-hmm. Please talk about the meaning in particular of that song.
I think that this is really ironic, because when you think of the black church and gospel music influencing civil rights type songs, one of the great ironies is Julian Bond, the great leader from Georgia, who, by the way, ran for president of the United States and was far ahead of his time. He could have been in a more liberal America, the Barack Obama of the 1960s.
He would have been better than that.
he would have been much better than that, a brilliant guy. And he talked about Guy Carwan, the organizer, who had adapted the idea of "I'll overcome" into "We shall overcome" as a guy he thought was a surfer. He had blonde hair, and he seemed completely out of place in these SNCC organizing meetings, and yet it was Guy Carwan who came up with that song that became one of the many songs that the civil rights movement adopted. One of the great ironies, I think, in music is power.
Brad, let's turn to Joan Baez for a minute. You write how American servicemen in Vietnam asked her to sing her biggest hit, "The Night They Drove Old Dixie Down," and that was written by Robbie Robertson of the band,
mm-hmm.
Showing the Confederacy's suffering and greed during what was then referred to as a war between the states. What was Baez's influence on social justice?
Well, I try not to be judgmental in Music is Power. There are some artists who did one important socio-political song, but in Joan's case, it was an entire career. It's kind of astounding. You know, she's there with Mario Savio at Berkeley during the beginning of the free speech movement, asking people to protest but not to be violent. She's there at the Alameda County Induction Center being spit upon by people going to Vietnam. Obviously, she goes to North Vietnam during one of the worst bombing campaigns of the United States. And Joan Baez, you know, she just celebrated her 75th birthday. She has spent her entire life committed to social justice. Even just a couple of years ago, she did a song that was anti-Trump and hilarious. So she's in a special place. She's in a pantheon of musicians and composers dedicated to social justice.
Let's talk to the challenges of getting socially conscious music recorded, released, and marketed. Briefly, can you tell us about Leslie Gore and Janice Ian?
Yeah, I loved writing the chapter about Leslie and Janice, because even though the 70s is credited with the birth of the women's movement, really, if you dig down deep into music, you find that the nascent women's movement really started almost as a fluke, because Leslie Gore was tired of singing about crying because Johnny broke her heart. And when two songwriters came to her with "You Don't Own Me," she was so excited that she went to her producer, who was a guy you may have heard of named Quincy Jones, and she said, "I want this to be my next song." And he saw it, and he fought for it, and needless to say, it was the first song that talked about equality for women in relationships. And it was 1964, so that's interesting, because Betty Friedan's The Feminine Mystique has come out, and the first, you know, American nonfiction book to suggest, you know what, maybe women have a role in society beyond just being mothers and housewives. So that was it for Leslie, but it had a huge impact. And of course, Janice Ian, she's 16 years old when she writes Society's Child and talks about a white girl and a black boy who fall in love. And sadly, when she was performing that in some clubs, people would scream epithets at her, use the N-word, and yet it had a huge impact itself. So I think Janice and Leslie are very special women in terms of this musical movement of the book.
Brad, I wanted to ask you about Pete Seeger. He went to Harvard, dropped out, and he was told there, you write, by a professor who said, you can't change the world, you can only analyze it. Well, that's an ironic thing. Talk about Pete Seeger's relationship with the Red Scare and the group that he was in, the Weavers.
Yeah, well, with all due respect to his professor at Harvard, I disagree with that. It's not turning the world upside down through your art, but it's changing consciousness, and that's really where it starts. The Red Scare ruined the career of Pete Seeger and the Weavers, and, of course, he was blacklisted for his association with groups that were identified as being communist. It took the Smothers Brothers, Michael, of all people, to break the blacklist against Pete Seeger performing. I'm old enough to remember watching the broadcast when Pete Seeger performed Waist Deep in the Big Muddy, ostensibly a song about army men on maneuvers in Louisiana following their leader who's leading them into a river that is slowly submerging them to their deaths. And, of course, in the song, Pete Seeger refers to the big fool. The big fool says to push on, and it's a clear shot across the bow at Lyndon Johnson. Well, just to show you how different times were, 75,000 letters come into CBS protesting Pete Seeger and, you know, his performance of Waist Deep in the Big Muddy. You know, now, you know, we have absolutely no civility in political discourse.
Seeger testified before the House Un-American Activities Committee. He was hauled in front of them, and he was asked if he ever sung for communist audiences. And he replied, "I've sung for Americans of every political persuasion, and I'm proud of that, and I'll never refuse to sing for an audience, no matter what religion or color of their skin or situational life." And the next year, the House of Representatives found Seeger guilty of 10 counts of contempt of Congress, and the sentence was eventually overturned by a court of appeals on a technicality. But Pete Seeger was courageous. He didn't take the Fifth Amendment. He took the First Amendment. He said, "I got a right to do what I'm doing, and you guys, you want to hear me sing a song, I'd be glad to sing a song for you." Remember that?
He's very much like Joan Baez, in my opinion. It was a lifelong commitment. It wasn't just, you know, what happened in Motown. They had, you know, socially conscious psychedelia, you know, for a brief while. Norman Whitfield as producer going, "Oh, wow, you know, this socially conscious stuff like Ball of Confusion. Ah, we got to try this out." Joan and Pete, literally their entire lives, their professional lives, committed to change. You know, Pete Seeger, he lived in Beacon in upstate New York, and he has this beautiful house. He could easily have retired. No, he's going to start being an activist to clean the water of the Hudson River. That's the kind of guy Pete Seeger was. To his last breath, he was trying to make the world better.
Brad, in your chapter on punk bands like Green Day and the Sex Pistols, you note that major record chains refuse to carry the Sex Pistols single God Save the Queen and BBC banned it. You write that, quote, "While the Pistols often transcended the boundaries of taste, it can be argued that expressing their rage at an unbalanced social system was the point, irrespective of refinement, musicianship, or respectability."
Yeah.
Did their audience get their message?
That is a fantastic question. And let me first say that a lot of people think that Green Day is a hard rock band with kind of punk overtones rather than purely punk. Let me just say very quickly about them before moving on to the Pistols, that Green Day, I believe, has had a huge cultural impact because of the musical version of American Idiot. What they did, in essence, with that musical and condemning the Iraq War is connecting older social activists who protested the Vietnam War to a continuum of activism and social consciousness. And, of course, American Idiot reached a lot of young people who weren't political. So they go to see the music of Green Day, and they start thinking about what is the pattern of America at war. So I think, Green Day and American Idiot is very important. Your question about the Sex Pistols is one that really fascinates me, as a matter of fact, Heidi, because to a great degree, I'm saying in Music is Power that the Sex Pistols weren't so much an activist band. They were almost part of a social movement that included music. Malcolm McLaren, their manager, I quote him in Music is Power as going, I don't care whether they can play music. He just loved the outrageousness of their performance, and if they got arrested, all the better. The fact is that the Sex Pistols, while not a great music band, shook up English society, in which there was incredible unfairness between the working class, the unemployed youth, and, of course, the upper classes. So shocking English society by making fun of the Queen, you could say, is nihilism. But I don't think it is just nihilism. I think it's a way of saying we drop out of your society because there's no place for us anyway. And literally people who were dressed as punks were being beaten on the streets of London. American punk music was not a copycat, because that sounds derogatory, but it certainly didn't have the social impact that it did in the UK.
Now, switching genres here for a minute, let's talk about Bob Marley's relevance to social justice music. He got death threats from the Jamaican Labour Party. Why was that, and why is Peter Gabriel in the same chapter with Marley?
Well, I guess you could say that they're both in the same chapter in Music is Power because they're both internationalists in terms of their messages. I'm very lucky in that I live here in Los Angeles, and I know Roger Steffens, who is probably the foremost mind on Bob Marley, and his book, So Many Things to Say, really captures Marley's life and his activism. And it's fascinating because in Jamaica, Marley found himself caught between the Jamaican Labor Party and Edward Seaga, who, by the way, had connections to the American CIA.
Edward Seaga. Seaga. I remember.
Yeah, that's exactly right, Michael. On the walls of Trenchtown, people would write Edward CIAGA instead of SEAGA. So there was the battle between America's fear of Jamaican society, being run by Michael Manley, who was obviously much more progressive, and the candidate they wanted, Edward Seaga. And both sides used gang warfare to try and control what was going on in Kingston. And Bob Marley, you'll read in the book, Music is Power, that he took a bullet, or there was an attempt on his life, and he still went on performing and committed to freedom and social justice. And that message phenomenally went worldwide. It wasn't just in Jamaica. To my mind, Peter Gabriel is sort of the same kind of worldwide ambassador. He became that especially with his song Biko, about Stephen Biko, the South African activist who was murdered in a jail cell. But if you look into the kind of art rock origins of Genesis, where Peter Gabriel started, you see that he has an incredible array of songs that are about social justice. Get 'Em Out by Friday is a song about aged pensioners being moved out of their homes in England. The Battle of Epping Forest is a fantastic and one of the funniest social justice songs in the book, about two rival gangs killing each other in a woodsy area of London in order to have control. So, you know, Gabriel wrote about a phenomenal variety of social issues, and both he and our dear pal in Jamaica, Bob Marley, phenomenal ambassadors of social justice and music.
In 2006, Gabriel received the Man of Peace Award at the 7th World Summit of Nobel Peace Laureates convening in Rome. I hadn't known that.
Yeah, and he's so modest. That's the amazing thing about him. He doesn't talk about it at all. Obviously, his tours for Amnesty International were incredibly successful and expanded awareness of that organization. It's phenomenal because this is a guy who can write Biko, or he can write about Arthur Bremer in Family Snapshot, Arthur Bremer being the, you know, assassin of George Wallace. And then he can write like an R&B hit, like Sledgehammer. He's incredibly gifted, and he also expanded the palette of music, you know, bringing in, you know, Afro-Cuban kind of music. He's obviously in WOMAD, in that festival, he's expanded the consciousness of other musical artists around the world. I can't say enough about what he has done.
Brad, we just have a few minutes remaining,
yeah.
And there's so much left, from the Dixie Chicks to Frank Zappa. We wanted to ask you about your chapter on rap music, where you talk about impediments for black musicians who are critical of American society. How do white record executives view rap? And is it up to black labels to take the lead in getting these songs out?
Well, I think it was in the very beginning, absolutely, before rap was called hip-hop. You know, everybody credits the South Bronx with, you know, the origins of rap music. But now, of course, it's pervasive, and it's culturally accepted everywhere, but not politically conscious rap. I talk about Gil Scott-Heron, whose great poetry preceded street poetry and the popularity of hip-hop. And then I, of course, include, you know, Grandmaster Flash and Public Enemy and N.W.A. and the songs that they wrote that were socially conscious and extremely important. But that music form is now a worldwide phenomenon. I think what I try to say in Music is Power is, let's go back to Gil Scott-Heron. Let's go back to The Revolution Will Not Be Televised, and look at some of the fantastic poetry that was socially conscious, and include that in the oeuvre of hip-hop or rap music today.
Brad, it's really interesting talking with you. You know, when I started reading your book, it starts off with Joe Hill, then Pete Seeger and Woody Guthrie, and I was thinking, you know, what songs did they do that I really love? And I like Preacher and the Slave, Joe Hill's song, you know, mocking these religious fundamentalists who tried to take over the IWW.
As a matter of fact, very few American artists have mocked anything about religious hypocrisy since that 1911 song, Michael. Frank Zappa, who I was fortunate enough to work with for 6 months and got to know very well, would talk about the religious fundamentalism as well as the PMRC, the Parents Music Resource Center, which was advocating censorship of music lyrics. I not only greatly admire all the music that he did, but also the fact that he put his money where his mouth is, and he put up tens of thousands of dollars, of 1980 dollars, to make people aware that the government was trying to censor music lyrics.
The other songs that I thought of when I was reading your first couple chapters was Solidarity Forever, which I first learned on a Weavers album, Talking Union, and then a beautiful song of Woody Guthrie's, Deportees. And I was thinking, you know, if I had to choose between all the various songs that you're talking about, I think that Woody Guthrie song, Deportees, which is so relevant to today, would be my favorite.
Yeah, the subtitle, Michael, on that being, you know, Plane Wreck at Los Gatos, 1948 air crash of Mexicans who were being deported. And, you know, Guthrie was irate because they didn't even list their names in the papers. They were just deportees, nameless entities. And what's gone on under the Trump administration, I mean, this will be historic. The lack of compassion in this administration toward people from another country, this will be a low point compared to what was going on when Woody Guthrie was writing songs like Do Re Mi and, of course, Deportees.
Yeah, exactly. Stephen Miller, the immigration guru for Trump, somebody wrote that he's got the soul of a Nazi, and that's for sure. If we have a chance, we'll play some of the Woody Guthrie song, Deportees. Heidi, you had something?
Well, we are running out of time, and I was interested in the Frank Zappa chapter because he's in a class of his own.
Yeah.
I think our listeners are going to have to get your wonderful book to learn about his early years, his suspicion of government agencies, and note that his song More Trouble Every Day was an indictment of the 1965 Watts race riots. So there's so much more in the book that we weren't able to get to, Brad, but it's a wonderful, wonderful book that anyone interested in music and or social justice should read.
I believe in closing, you guys, that we can inspire people who are otherwise disgusted with politics by music, because music psychologically impacts people in a way that political speech-making never can. And, you know, I'm trying to encourage not only people to listen to politically conscious music, but to inspire more artists to occasionally use the power that they have to move people to action to better the world. It's a phenomenal force, and it historically is borne out by Farm Aid and Live Aid, and in the UK, the Secret Policeman's Ball. Music is a motivating force for changing the ills of the world.
The book is Music is Power, Popular Songs, Social Justice, and the Will to Change by Brad Schreiber. Brad, we'd love to have you on again. We understand you're working on a new book, and we want to be among the first to talk to you about that.
Oh, that'd be great. I really enjoyed it, and I really appreciate what you guys do regarding social justice. So thank you very much.
Thank you, Brad.
You take it easy.
If you have any comments or questions about this segment or any others, please visit us at lawanddisorder.org. That's lawanddisorder.org.